kids, Batsugundo here, and I must apologize for that savage interloper who appeared here last week. I do not approve of his antics, in large part because I was once positioned for a nationwide audience myself, and that blackguard absconded with my players. Of course, it's small beer to relish in the man's fall from grace, so instead I'll just confess that I am a reader of depressing books, and as such, I am very glad that our young roving correspondent has tracked down Tao Lin, a young 23-year-old writer who may be a little bit more happier than I am.
Okay, so I'm here with Tao Lin, author of E, as well as Bed, as well as a poetry collection called You Are a Little Bit Happier Than I Am. Tao, how are you doing?
I'm good.
So, Tao, I wanted to actually ask you, first of all, about the novel. This is the one I think that really kind of, I read all three of these books, and this one sort of was reminiscent of kind of Murakami meets Less Than Zero, and I'm wondering, in the way that it actually sort of has a slacker coming up against sort of these really wild imaginative elements. Now, I'm wondering, was Murakami ever an influence for you? Where does this kind of fantastical sort of elements come from?
I've read a lot of Murakami, but I don't think he influenced the novel. I think when I first wrote the novel, it was completely realistic. And
really?
I was influenced more by Ann Beattie's Chilly Scenes of Winter. Okay. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
I'm actually, unfortunately, a Visigoth when it comes to Ann Beattie, so I'm going to have to go ahead and correct that.
I was completely influenced by her. If you read her novel, you can tell that I took Summer's, like, the tone of it.
Now, you say that this novel was originally written in a realistic form, and I note that the stories in Bed are surprisingly realistic. There aren't much in the way of dolphins or bears or the like. So what caused these bears and dolphins to kind of enter into the equation? Did you find them to be a friendly presence to draw upon? Or?
Well, after I finished the novel in a realistic fashion, I kept on working on it, and I just felt bored by it. I thought I needed something exciting, so I just went through. Whenever there's a bored part where I felt bored, I deleted some of it and added the animals into it.
Now, these dolphins are rather murderous. They actually go after Elijah Wood and company. What accounts for these violent impulses of these animals?
I just thought it was fun to write, having a dolphin murder Elijah Wood.
But this is Elijah Wood we're talking about. Has Elijah Wood ever done anything to you personally? Or?
No, he hasn't. But did you think it was mean of I was mean against him, or it was just playful?
Well, it is both playful, but I guess another person who might be an Elijah Wood fan might read this book and say, wow, this is a lot, very quite violent against, you know, a person who we only know from the movies. I mean, you know, and we know from his public life that is spread across the National Enquirer or whatnot. Not just Elijah Wood, but you also have Salman Rushdie and George Bush, essentially, targets of violence here. Why lock on to these particular celebrities as opposed to sort of, you know, Andrew himself?
I thought it was just funny because in conversation that's the kind of thing I'll talk about with friends.
Oh, really? So you talk about dolphins and bears with friends then, and this is kind of how it kind of came into your fiction? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Like in Gmail chat, if I'm talking with a friend, that's the kind of jokes I would make. Like, what if a dolphin was really depressed and killed Elijah Wood?
Gotcha. So I guess you would say the Gmail chat and, like, Instant Messenger, where you describe in the first book, I've had some of the happiest moments of my life in Instant Messenger. These are sort of ways for you to kind of find inspiration or find ideas or find kinds of ways to shed this not-so-fun realist prose.
Yeah, definitely. When I wrote the stories in Bed, I felt it was very completely different than what I would, in Gmail chat, I would enjoy. Like, if I talk about the kind of things in Bed and Gmail chat, I would feel bored or just interminable because it wasn't playful or spontaneous enough. But in Gmail chat, I sometimes type something and I like it a lot. But I just do it spontaneously. But the stories in Bed were very not contrived, but deliberate.
Is this kind of how the one sentence, all lower caps thing kind of came about for reader of depressing books and also the chapbook? Were you trying to sort of replicate this Gmail chat or instant messenger kind of vernacular? Or?
No, the Gmail chat came later. Started Gmail. The blog started, and then about half a year later, I got Gmail chat.
So are there any advantages to Gmail chat over instant messenger, would you say? Or?
Gmail chat's better because you can check your email file chat. Okay. Do you use Gmail?
I don't use Gmail. I use Yahoo Mail.
You should use Gmail.
Well, the problem about Gmail is that there's that whole privacy sort of thing. Not that Yahoo is... Yahoo also has privacy issues too, but I don't like the idea of giving Gmail every little detail about myself. You know?
I never looked into that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things in those EULAs. You know, very terrifying things. You know, that they're collecting all this information upon you. They're collecting your creativity here, Tao. And they may actually use it to sell things to you.
I didn't know. When you type emails in Gmail chat, there's always advertisements on the side targeting you.
Well, okay, so the internet is influential to your writing. I mean, maybe you can sort of describe again how this is a sort of muse for you to come up with these ideas. I mean, how does something that you have, you know, discussed with a friend in Gmail chat turn into possibly a story or turn into another sort of idea that is then... has another home on say Reader of Depressing Books, or even like, you know, maybe your duties as 3 a.m. magazine as poetry editor?
I feel more creative when I'm chatting with someone that is like similar to me in sense of humor and stuff than when I'm just sitting alone typing into a Word document. So before, for the two books you read, or three books. I mean, the two books by Melville House, I wasn't much influenced by that.
Yeah.
But for my next book, I think... For my next book, I have sections where I just copy and paste it from Gmail chat into the novel.
Really? So, for the Melville House books, which I definitely got a different feel myself when I read those, I mean, what did you draw upon for this? Did you want to kind of close the gates and sort of, you know, circle the wagons here so that you wouldn't be influenced by Gmail, or what... What happened here? Were you tired of the kind of one sentence poetry approach?
For the story collection, I wasn't Gmail chatting that. I didn't talk to anyone much during that time. I just wrote and read all the time, and I studied like traditional short stories. Like I read a lot of best American short story collections, and then. I was most influenced by Laurie Moore and Joy Williams, I think.
Yeah, who also crop up as names in the various stories and the like. Is this a way for you to sort of celebrate these inspirations? Or why, again, going back to this issue of why use these celebrity names, so to speak, or these literary names in your work, do you feel that they kind of provide a heft, or what's the motivation here?
I think I'm just, when I write, a lot of the characters are just myself, so, and since those writers are so much a part of my life, they just find their way into it naturally.
Okay. Now, let's talk maybe perhaps about one of these characters. Like, Andrew, I would say, is a bit more fleshed out than your other characters who are, as you, by your own admission, drawn from yourself, but he's a pizza delivery man, he's a movie theater manager, at least a short-lived movie theater manager. He lives with his parents, he frequently visits New York. I'm wondering, you know, how close is Andrew to you? Or, I mean, what's the level of invention that you do where you have to kind of go off the beaten track because, like, oh, shit, here's a Bildungs Roman, I can't do that, you know?
Andrew is maybe exactly like me, but back then, like a year ago.
Okay.
A lot of the scenes were taken exactly from my life, including most of the dialogue. So
really,
I'll say that Andrew is me back then.
So you rely upon your friends for dialogue and narrative exposition and the like, or
about half of it was taken exactly from real life.
Okay.
But the other halves, if even though they're made up, I want to think, what would Andrew say in the situation? I'll just think, what would I say in the situation? or do.
So then, you know, the dolphins and the bears, this comes from real life? I mean, or is there some sort of thinking that you do to kind of come up with, you know, dolphins murdering and flying from L.A. to New York and the like?
The hamsters were... During that time, I thought hamsters were really funny for some reason.
Yeah?
So I was always talking about hamsters with my friends. I think I added the hamsters first, and then I also think moose are funny, and I added the moose.
Well, what's been your experience with animals over the years? Just have you had any personal experience with animals to draw from, or?
I'm amused by animals. I like looking at animals, like the Discovery Channel or something.
Yeah. But then why does the dolphin become a murderous homicidal maniac? That's the question here, you know?
Because he's just really depressed and needed an outlet for his depression.
But there's also this aspect of, like, him giving money to Andrew and Andrew sort of rejecting it. So there's this aspect to it, too. So I'm wondering, does the murderous impulse, is it there all along and you need some sort of additional kind of hook to it to sort of make it a little bit larger than life? Or?
I don't think there's any more intent behind it except that I thought it was funny. More exciting than just having it all be realistic.
So writing any story for you is just largely to entertain or to make it funny, then?
No, I think the novel without the parts that were just exciting to me or entertaining or funny, it felt boring to me. But the realistic parts, I didn't write just to entertain or be funny. I think I wrote them to figure out things or to calm myself down.
What do you mean figure out things and calm yourself down?
By figure out things, I mean like figure out what I should do with my life or things like how to act in a certain situation. Like some of the parts in the novel were like long parts of rhetoric about the universe or something.
Yeah, though there's a bit of an existential, philosophical sort of aside by these various characters who are sitting around wondering what to do with their lives, and then, you know, that's why I sort of kind of thought of Less Than Zero, which had a similar sort of thing going for it when he wrote that.
And by calm me down, I mean, like, if I feel really depressed or something, and then I write about it, I can see that by feeling really depressed, I'm giving myself too much significance. Really, I'm just insignificant. And by writing, I can see that clearly.
And yet, there's been a sort of a bit of a controversy with your Wikipedia entry, where for a while, they were claiming that you weren't significant enough to warrant Wikipedia attention. And in fact, in the discussion page, it says, and I'm not sure who wrote this because no one signed for it, but it says, Tao has an attitude problem and seriously craves attention. So perhaps for the benefit of all parties, you could respond to this controversy. Do you have an attitude problem and do you crave attention? And what is this nature of significance that you speak of?
I don't think I have an attitude problem. The other day, someone told me that someone else had emailed them saying that they hated me or something. And I said, I don't know why people hate me.
Yeah. Well, what do you think accounts for the sometimes strenuous kind of reactions to some of your work?
I can understand why people think I crave attention. Because I always do things to try to get attention.
Yeah.
But I think I can... I think based on... After thinking about self-promotion and things like that, I think I really have no choice but to try to get a lot of attention, because I make decisions based on morals, I think.
Morals? Like,
yeah.
What type of morals? I mean, what would you define your moral code by?
Like, I'm very conscious of where I spend my money or what I eat and things like that. And if I really want to be moral, I should promote myself, since I think that, for example, if someone else had $1 million, They might spend it at McDonald's or something.
Yeah.
But if I had $1 million, I would buy like organic vegan food and only spend it at independent venues. So based on that, I would be required to promote myself in order to get more money to take it away from the people who would spend it at McDonald's so I can spend it at better places.
Okay, so let's try to actually establish a connection between organic vegan food, which is a part of who you are, your writing, this $1 million, and McDonald's. Is the writing a way to kind of, I guess, draw attention to this more moral approach of eating, for example, through organic vegan foods? Or?
The writing isn't moral at all, I don't think. I view life, if I wanted to write a moral book, I would write a nonfiction book. And it'll tell you exactly what to do and why to do it. But when I write a fiction book, I don't think morally, I think existentially. And from that viewpoint, there are no morals. But I know that it's impossible to live without morals because each moment we're making choices. So for my real life, I need morals or else I have no way to decide how to act, like what to do when I wake up. But for my fiction, it has no morals. It's just, I really haven't reconciled the two. My fiction and my real life. I don't know how to do it.
Is this what you're kind of trying to do as you write more stories, just to have a more kind of, I guess, personal connection between this moral dilemma that you're facing and the existential kind of flatline, so to speak, or the kind of open possibility of choices that people like Andrew face? Is this your kind of way you're hoping to kind of corral this then?
To figure it out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Just by living day by day, I can't figure out how to reconcile existential issues with moral issues. But in my fiction, I can try to do that.
Okay, well, for example, let's go ahead and take a few of these things. Two things that come to mind. I'll start with the shit-eating grins that are in EEE. Why dwell at length upon shit-eating grins? Not everyone has to do that, but at the same time, this is also kind of something that if you work in the service sector, you're going to have to put on a shit-eating grin, or you're going to have to put on a false grin. Is presenting the shit-eating grin, is it just something that you find amusing, or is there some sort of larger sort of societal connection you're trying to make, something along these lines of corralling your own morals with this open territory of the fiction?
The shit-eating grins was just amusing, I think. I think I make a lot of shit-eating grins in real life.
You're giving me one right now.
What do you think? Does it look like one?
It looks like actually a fairly genuine grin, I would say. I hope so, anyway.
I just thought shit-eating grins were funny.
Yeah.
I do it a lot.
Well, what about this whole notion of cutting-edgedness? You have all of the entities in this book, whether it be Domino's Pizza, whether it be like the movie theater, and there are a number of others, various entities that live and die by how cutting edge they are. I mean, is this just kind of a word that you hear and you kind of just place into the story, or?
I don't think I've ever heard anyone use it in real life. I just thought it had a lot of potential to be applied to different things, so I use it as a motif.
So it's kind of a tertiary thing you might hear from Gmail chat or from IM that you'll then sort of dwell upon and then try to place within the actual fiction? Or?
Yeah. If you read Chilly Scenes of Winter by Anne Beattie, she has a lot of recurring things, like that the person is always thinking. I find that realistic. Like if I have hamsters in my head, wherever I go, I'll think about hamsters. And I think that's funny, so.
How many hours a day would you say that you devote to writing or that you devote to sending things out. I mean, I don't think people realize this, but you've been in 14 Hills, the Mississippi Review, other voices. You're not just some guy who's just like, you know, slapping things up onto the internet. You're actually getting into, some pretty decent literary journals. So I guess I want to ask you, I mean, you have quite a few detractors. How would you describe your literary worth, and what do you do just to work hard at this to actually keep sending things out, to keep generating material?
When I wrote the story collection in a novel, I didn't really hang out with anyone or do anything else except read and write. So I wrote about, I would say, 3 to 6 hours a day and spent most of the other time reading or thinking about writing. So I would go to the library when I woke up and drink coffee and then work for as long as I could while still feeling creative from the coffee. And I'll be like 2 or 3 hours. And then I'll go do something else, and then later on do that again.
Well, I mean, how does the internet factor into this? Because obviously, you've had, I don't know how many different blogspot domains. I mean, there's got to have been at least 5 or 6. So, I mean, clearly this is a factor into, you know, how you kind of corral all these various thoughts and these ideas and these impulses.
I think I only started my blog after I finished the story collection and after I finished most of the novel. But I wrote the poems while I had the blog.
But you're also, like, for example, you put up recently at Reader of Depressing Books a list of all the stories in bed along with a Google word count. What, is this just fun, or there's got to be some additional association here? You also send a lot of emails to people, too. I've gotten a lot of emails from you. I've got a lot of comments from you.
I just felt, after I wrote those two books, I felt, I don't know, maybe bored or something. And I just wanted to do something. So I started a blog. And the reason I would post things like the thing you talk about where I post a Google search and word counts of stories is just, maybe just to keep people coming back to the blog so they'll be interested.
Ah, so you do crave attention here.
Well, yeah, I want to sell books. I don't feel guilty promoting myself because I think if I sell a lot of books, Melville House will make more money, and I trust Melville House to publish books that are moral, that other people wouldn't publish. For example, Celia Farber's AIDS book. Have you read that?
Not yet.
I think a book like that can reduce pain and suffering in the world if a lot of people read it.
Do you feel that you can reduce pain and suffering if people experience EEE? Or
maybe severely depressed people could, but not like Celia Farber's book would. But I think if I had a lot of money, I could reduce pain and suffering in the world, maybe.
Well, how did you get hooked up with Dennis in the first place?
I sent Dennis a link to one of my blog posts about Lori Moore. And then he read my blog that I had a story collection. And then he solicited that. And about 5 months later, he emailed back saying he was interested in publishing it.
Now, what about the novel? Were you working on that at the same time? Or, because this is a double deal here where we have both of these books coming out, I guess May 15th, because there's a little sticker on my galley that seems to have been kind of replacing the Soviet Bureau or something. Did you basically sort of insist upon a kind of like, well, I'll give you the short story collection if you publish this book, or how did that come about?
No, Dennis only knew about the story collection when he decided to publish it. And about 3 to 6 months later, I sent him the novel. And then we discussed how to publish it. And we discussed publishing both in the same book, like your galley. And we just finally decided on 2 books at the same time.
I wanted to actually ask you, I did promise that I would ask you about writing workshops, because you have a BA in journalism. And there's a story called Sincerity that offers a interesting approach or a glimpse of writing workshops where you have the main character, Aaron. He decides to infiltrate his girlfriend's writing workshop and cause trouble for the teacher, who's uninterested in the student's work and causes all sort of, you know, mischief. Are you pro or con writing workshops? Or, are again, is this a kind of tertiary sort of experience that you hear from someone else that you kind of recycle into a story like this sincerity? Or
I have a BA in journalism, but I think I took as many or even more writing workshops than like MFA students. Because I took at least one writing workshop every semester for about eight semesters. I don't think I'm pro or con for writing workshops. They're just, if you're a person who isn't easily influenced by other people's criticism, then like an MFA, I don't think it would influence your writing. But if you're a person easily influenced, then you're going to be easily influenced anyway by other things, even if you don't go to an MFA.
Now, have you ever sent a resume as a blank Word document? Does that come from a real experience? Because I thought that was a rather funny idea. I may actually try that myself at some point just to see what happens.
That was real. My roommate, Nick Intosca, he's also a writer. He referred me to his financial company, and I sent a blank document.
Why did you do that? Did you do that deliberately? Or?
No, by accident. I really wanted a job. They never contacted me.
Now, do you have a day job right now? Or how do you manage all this? You know, you describe 3 to 6 hours and then 2 hours here. That's quite a lot of time that a lot of people don't have to write.
During that time, I had a job working at the library at New York University. And I was taking classes, and I was a junior and senior then. Right now, I don't have a job. I'm just getting little money things from various places.
You had a story in Nerve recently, which was a little bit of a departure from you. How did you approach the sort of specifics of sex, which you had kind of alluded to sort of obliquely in some of the stories in bed?
I just tried to write about it like I would write about anything else. Because when I read their sex stories, I felt, I don't like when people write about sex and try to be like a badass. Or
a badass?
Yeah.
Maybe you mean like turning people on too much or what? I've read erotica, and I don't think, hey, the writer's a badass. You know, it's like, I think Samuel L. Jackson, yeah, he's definitely a badass in his films.
Maybe badass is the wrong word.
Maybe Samuel L. Jackson should write erotica, I don't know.
I just try to write about it like I would write anything else.
Which would be how exactly? I mean, just, I know you've, like, okay, let me help you out here. I know that you've said in a few other interviews that you kind of pride yourself on not having any particular rules that you follow, that you kind of just, that you don't really know the rules, and you're just kind of like figuring this thing out as you write each particular story. So maybe you can describe how one of these stories germinates, how you write, say, a Nerve sex story like you write anything else. What is this anything else? I know it's a rather general question, but I'm hoping that we can kind of get into some specifics here.
It changes all the time. For example, the stories in bed, I wouldn't write those kind of stories anymore. I would think they're too much like I was trying to show off or be too authoritative. Now I would write something where maybe the sentences are less grammatical, but more like, if I was talking to someone really fast, I would use like maybe switch adjectives and nouns or something like that.
So you really want to basically deliberately mangle grammar in your stuff now?
Not deliberately, just to match maybe how I talk to people, maybe. Like, I would say I feel interminable, but I don't think is that grammatical?
No, that actually works. Oh. If you feel the question is it, we need some sort of additional context here. If you feel interminable, you feel, well, does your life, we must assume that, you know, you feel as if your life is interminable, which most people, I suppose, would say, but you're basically saying, I feel interminable, but then again, you leave a bit of a bleak, idea here that you could feel interminable about anything. Well, I mean, why say something like that? I mean, why mix nouns and adjectives and meanings like this up?
In a way, I feel it's more complex and more reflective of how the human brain works.
Well, how does the human brain work?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about.
No. I mean, if you're trying to get some sort of general sort of, you know, aspects here where you feel that the human brain works if things are sort of mangled like this. Well, I could also argue, yes, the human brain does sometimes work like this because we regularly utter things that, you know, make no grammatical sense, that if they were transcribed, you would sort of say, what the hell is this? So I guess is your your efforts here, I would aver, have something to do with trying to kind of, I guess, recapture the fallacies and the flaws of everyday behavior or discourse?
Maybe. I don't know what that means.
Okay, well, you want to get a sort of more malapropism, a sort of false reading that we all kind of utter in our everyday speech, something like that. That's.
I don't think it's false. I just think it's more maybe more without preconception. For example, like a little kid would say something like, they always say things like, I feel like a watermelon or something. And like adults wouldn't say that. But kids, since they don't know rules or haven't lived that long to be influenced by what's normal, they'll say things like that. And I like things like that.
Now, is your fiction then sort of a way for you to kind of, I guess, postpone this sort of childlike approach towards, you know, these utterances that are essentially pure, uncorrupted, unaligned with particular mores or folkways of our everyday sort of society? I mean, you're 24, right?
23.
Okay. So you're 23. How long do you think you can kind of keep this thing going? Because inevitably, a person's life, your life is really going to change in the next 10 years. I can tell you that from personal experience.
So, I hope forever. I don't want to postpone it. I want to make it the main way of thinking, which is without preconception. I think a 10-year-old could look at a situation a lot more clearly than most adults, and in a way that could solve problems better, not just in like a cute way.
But what makes you think people will look to this work as a way of finding this new ideology or this new kind of way of looking at the world? I mean, you know, that's a pretty idealistic thing to say there, Tao.
I don't think it'll change people to think more like it. I don't know how to reconcile that with, like, I would say it would be moral of me or political if I wanted to change people with my fiction.
Yeah. So it's more morals than politics, because the word you keep coming back to here is moral.
I think morals and politics are the same thing.
Really?
Something that is moral is also political, I think.
Okay, that's cool. I wanted to actually ask you about how you have inanimate objects like, you know, cans and boxes and cereal boxes essentially say things, you know, you have them say something, as opposed to, you know, you don't hear the crack open of a can, you hear the can goes or whatnot. So how did this kind of stylistic tick of yours come about? Why do all these unconscious objects have to say things in your writing?
I think I got it from Joy Williams. She had it in some of her stories, and I just thought it was really funny. And also, it makes me feel better to think that inanimate objects can think and have feeling.
Okay, so basically, conscious inanimate objects And talking animals who murder people, this is your way of getting through the world, or?
Partly. Without those kind of things, we'll just be really interminable. Like, without imagination or whatever it is.
Well, let's ask. Would you describe your current life as interminable? You've got some books out. You've got some attention. You're getting these stories put. You've got the nerve story. Is this an interminable life? Do you fear perhaps, you know, someone might, like, sort of say, oh, this Tao Lin guy, he writes crazy shit, so, you know, why don't we go ahead and use him for his voice? But they may miss this larger point that you're trying to convey here of, well, you're trying to sort of recapture this childlike view of how of perception. What steps are you going to take to kind of prevent this possible sort of corruption of your voice?
I think the more people try, the more someone criticizes me, I feel impervious to criticism against my art, because I don't think there's good or bad in art. There's just what different people enjoy. But if someone criticizes my life, I'm affected by that. But if someone criticizes my actions in life, I'll think about it and see if it's right or wrong and do something about it. But if someone criticizes my writing, I'm not affected by it.
But in your case, a lot of your writing is in relation to your actions. For example, there was the whole, you know, situation with Kevin Samsel, where you posted all of this private email publicly. Now, you may think that's a perfectly moral thing to do, but by and large, and you also did it also when you guest appeared at the Oscar blog, where you're posting someone's private sort of messages publicly, and it's this invasion of privacy. I mean, so as a result, they look to this and they say, well, you know, Tao seems like this interesting sort of perspective, but why is he doing this? Why is he, like, you know, invading people's privacy like this? I mean, you know, what if something like this? I mean, obviously, it's kind of almost, you know, intellectually tied into each other, these two points, however unfairly it might be. I mean, people are going to be judging you on your personal actions, even though they have no bearing on your writing, and they're going to continue to do that. I mean, this again goes back to this question of being corrupted, are these sorts of outside actions moot, or what?
You mean what effect it has on how people read my fiction? Like, I think people who... I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, man, is that, you know, when you post Keith Gessen's private email, or Kevin Samsel's private email, people say, whoa, if this guy's doing that, I mean, you know... What's the issues with the guy's mentality? Even though you could be a perfectly reasonable guy, your fiction itself could present a very unusual perspective. So inevitably, there in your case, I suspect you have certain unnamed bloggers freaking out when you write about shoplifting. You know, I mean, there is an extraordinary reaction to what you decide to write about and how it reflects upon you personally. So what are you going to do? I mean, you know, to attempt to kind of illustrate to people, well, look, this is not reflective of my writing, and I mean, and do you mean any harm by these actions, or do you understand why people would be pissed off by this, or?
I don't intend to separate it from my writing. I think it's the same as my writing in that I try to think factually about a situation. I think if someone posted all my emails, that would be good, because I think privacy. A lot of bad things happen because of privacy. For example, I think the more information that is known, the more people's actions will be linked to the consequences they suffer. So I don't think posting other people's emails is bad by most people's definition of the word bad. But
see, you're essentially basically, okay, if we were to post all of your public emails, you would be cool with that. That's fine. But see, the thing is, and maybe this is a whole generational thing, but what we're seeing here is that other people who have experienced this right to privacy, this right to a private life, I mean, you know, for if I were to like send an email to, hey Tal, you know, I met this chick, she was like great in bed, you know, and then you were to go ahead and publicly post that, I'd be really pissed off at you. I mean, do you understand? I mean, is there a right to have that out there like that? I mean, that seems to me really. How can I send any emails to you if I know that you're going to, you know, publicly post them? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you don't even have my cell phone number. That's because of this very issue, you know?
I'm not sure if it's right to impose that onto someone else, but I think so far, as far as I've thought about it, I think other people would, if they knew all the facts, they would agree to post their emails. So by doing something that would make someone angry, it might make them think about it more.
But, you know, that's exactly what this Jason Fortuny guy, did you read this guy who basically pretended to be a woman? And it was Jason Fortuny, and there was another guy who then had to issue a video public apology, and I'm blanking on his name. But he would go into Craigslist, he would pretend to be a woman, and then these men would, like, send all these emails and these photos to them. And then this guy would then publicly post them and cause people to be fired, people to be, marriages to dissolve. I mean, this is not good. See, I'm trying to tell you, Tal, that when you do something like this, you're going to really cause people harm, you know? And not only that, but they're also going to look at you and they're going to say, well, I can't necessarily trust this Tal guy because he's going to post my public emails.
I think what you just described is good, though, because if a husband is trying to have an affair with a woman and the wife doesn't know that, it's better for both of them if the wife knows that so she can decide on the facts what to do with her life.
But what business is that of yours or anyone else's? That's between the husband and the wife. Adultery continues to happen all around us, you know? And that is the responsibility of the various sorts of parties. I mean, we've had whole resources of this, of the government money being devoted into looking into something that was between, you know, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. It had nothing to do with anything else. Yes, I suppose you have a certain point in that, it, you know, okay, can we actually trust this guy because he said no and then it's yes. But that's not our business. Our business, I mean, you know, how is this good to cause people harm?
In that situation you just described with the adultery, I think I agree with you, it isn't good. But with posting someone's email, I don't view it any different as, say, like a political campaign where you say it, where you tell someone they're not, tell someone to stop shopping at Walmart or something. And
no, but there's a major difference between sort of exposing what one person is privately saying to you, saying, look, Tal, I think you're a really good writer, but there are these things, and these things. I mean, you're exposing someone's private sort of thoughts to you, to help you, and you're basically disseminating them publicly, and then thus spoiling these sorts of, these very specific information that was given to you to help you. These people are trying to help you. They're not trying to, like, you know, to hurt you, and you in turn are going around and hurting them by putting up their emails like this. And you're, you know, and then another editor says, okay, well, I like what Tao's writing, but if he's posting my private emails to him publicly, well, then I'm going to go with someone else. I'm going to go with this guy, you know? I mean, I'm telling you, it's you seem like an all right guy, so why do this?
I feel almost obligated to do it based on how I view it, because say I'm having emails with someone where I'm talking shit about Salman Rushdie or someone. If Salman Rushdie had that information, he would be able to decide how to act in relation to me better than if he didn't have that information.
But you're assuming that Salman Rushdie has the time to actually track down this particular email. I mean, and maybe he will, but at the same time, you're also assuming that this piece of information will be of value to Salman Rushdie. So, I mean, why not just, like, you know, take this thing and maybe fictionalize it or something, which it sounds like you're doing with this personal experience.
I think I thought of a better way to explain it. I think if no one had privacy in the world at all, there would be all the horrible atrocities that happened, a lot of them probably would have been prevented, because a lot of bad things happen, not just politically, but you can use like the war on terror, for example, because the facts weren't known, because of privacy.
But you'd also basically, if people knew that their thoughts were being read, their emails were being publicly posted, what the hell would they do with ambition? You know, you'd immediately, things like, you know, Guernica would never actually be created if Picasso knew that all of his thoughts were being read. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a flip side to this debate, and that is that if people are going to be reluctant to reveal their true thoughts, their human thoughts to you, because they know that you're going to post their public emails.
I think if it came to be that there is no privacy anymore, people would adjust to that and still create good art or something. But also, they would be more careful of what they say. They would be less mean towards people, because they would know that everyone would be reading what they're writing.
But you're talking about these morals here, that like the books that Dennis is publishing, like this AIDS book. And that had to be a really private struggle to actually get that right. Now, if these, you know, whatever sort of communications were going on between Dennis and this AIDS author, and the early drafts of this book were unleashed, and then people would go ahead and say, oh, look at this piece of shit, this is nothing, why are they writing about another AIDS book? Then the very moral sorts of, you know, things that you're championing immediately, like, gone, you know? I mean, this may work perfectly well for you in terms of, like, trying to figure out how your own, try to figure things out, as you put it earlier, and how to figure how this ties into your fiction. But I'm saying, man, that, you know, there are virtues in privacy here. And there are virtues in maintaining someone's trust like this, because then they're going to reveal greater things to you because they know they can trust you. But and you'll learn things about the human universe that are fantastic, you know?
I don't understand how the AIDS book would be like crushed.
Did you not pay attention to these two girls who, you know, were trying to, like, you know, do this vagina monologues thing? And well, anyway, you know, they were prohibited. If they had had their private thoughts relayed, then they would not have actually put out the vagina monologues as it was actually intended to be. Because they told the principal, okay, well, we'll call it this or something. And they went ahead and privately decided, no, the integrity of the piece is that we actually perform the vagina monologues as is. And they did that, and they received a good deal of attention, and therefore the artistic integrity in the production of this particular piece was then sort of transformed. But in the Tao world, in which we totally abdicate all privacy, that would never have happened. See what I'm saying?
It still would have happened, I think. They would just have to find a different venue.
No, because there's no privacy. Everything, their phone calls, their conversations are being tapped, their emails are being tapped. Well, oh well, you know, too bad. They're going to have to keep all your thoughts to yourself.
Wait, how did the... Why would it be canceled if their private thoughts were known?
Because then, like, someone informs the principal, hey, guess what? You better crack down on these two girls, because they're going to go ahead and perform the vagina monologues as is. So, as a result, well, so much for championing the integrity of this play, because you, Talon, have decided that privacy should be completely surrendered, and these two girls aren't allowed to actually perform their particular piece, and they aren't allowed to really show the very moral integrity that we're talking about here in their production.
Well, I think it'll be better to try to influence the principal.
They tried though, man.
But now the principal is still gonna crack down on future people if they try to do something similar with the vagina monologues.
But at the same time, these girls have managed to do this, exposing the principal's lack of cultural integrity, lack of morality, and as a result, the next time he does something like this, well, people are going to object to it. People are going to raise more of a ruckus. So therefore, the moral integrity of this art, whether you like vagina monologues or not, still holds. And it's all because privacy was preserved. So I'm saying that... And And again, going back to the what I was, I hate this to be about me ranting like this, but I mean, I'm telling you, okay, we'll get off this subject. I'll ask you a few more questions. First of all, okay, have some of your happiest moments of life occurred through Instant Messenger?
I would say so, yeah.
Why is that?
I just have a lot of fun typing in Instant Messenger.
So it's all about fun then, or is it about communication, or what?
Experiencing creative moments with someone else in Instant Messenger.
Now, why did you use the second person voice in Insomnia for a Better Tomorrow? I'm curious about that. That was a little bit different from your usual style.
I don't think, no particular reason, just maybe I'd read some second person story during that time and liked it and wanted to do it.
Well, we are running actually out of tape. I didn't realize I was talking to you this so long, but Tao, pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.